From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the nuclear crisis with North Korea. Yesterday, the International Atomic Energy Agency declared North Korea in non-compliance with nuclear non-proliferation agreements and sent the issue to the UN Security Council. We'll talk with Nicholas Kristof, a New York Times columnist who has covered North and South Korea off and on since 1986. He served as the Times bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo. He's traveled to North Korea and Iraq and thinks North Korea has the more repressive regime. The disagreement over Iraq between the U.S. and France has led to a lot of French bashing here. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg, who has lived in France, has been listening in. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Pentagon officials are confirming a report that American special forces are already on the ground inside Iraq. The troops are linking up with potential rebel forces in Iraq and carrying out other missions. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from the Pentagon.
U.S. special forces have already been working openly in northern Iraq, where the territory is largely under the control of Kurdish rebel groups. The Washington Post on Thursday reported that U.S. special forces are actually operating in various parts of the country. A senior defense official confirms the Post report, although the official says the U.S. presence is not yet significant. Special operations forces, such as Army Green Berets and Navy SEALs, were the first U.S. troops on the ground in Afghanistan in the fall of 2001. Special forces were also placed inside Iraq early in 1991, even before the bombing began. Pentagon officials refuse to say how many U.S. troops have made their way into Iraq, nor what exactly they are doing. One key mission will be to establish links with rebel forces that could serve as potential U.S. allies. Tom Gelton, NPR News, the Pentagon.
A group of U.S. soldiers, soldiers' parents, and lawmakers filed suit today against President Bush and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. The suit asks for an immediate injunction to prevent the president from attacking Iraq without first getting a declaration of war from Congress. Six Democrats from the U.S. House are part of the suit, which says a resolution passed by Congress last fall was illegal because it didn't specifically declare war and left the decision to the president. The active duty military members who are part of the suit were not identified, but lawyers said they included a National Guard member and an Air Force reservist from Massachusetts and a U.S. Marine. President Bush told troops today that if there is a war against Iraq, the United States will win it. But Secretary of State Colin Powell told a House Budget Committee that Americans should be prepared for a lengthy commitment in the event of war. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
The Bush administration still says it has not made a decision to use force against Iraq, but it certainly is getting ready. As President Bush rallied the troops at the Mayport Naval Air Station in Florida, Secretary of State Powell answered questions on Capitol Hill about the potential cost of war and how long it might last. Powell said he couldn't provide an estimate of the cost, but he said that Iraq, unlike Afghanistan, should be able to recover quickly from war because of its oil resources and effective bureaucracy. Tomorrow, the chief UN Weapons inspectors give the Security Council their latest assessment of Iraq's level of compliance with UN demands to disarm. The U.S. says that report will bolster Washington's assertion that weapons inspections will not work and military action may be necessary. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 8 points to close at 7,749 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost a point to close at 1,277. This is NPR News. Investigators say they believe that searing hot gases penetrated the space shuttle Columbia and contributed to its breakup over Texas on February 1st. But the conclusion doesn't point directly to a root cause, NPR's Richard Harris reports.
NASA has known all along that temperatures rose sharply inside the shuttle's left wing and on the left side of the fuselage in the final 5 minutes of its flight. NASA engineers have now taken a close look at those measurements. They conclude that hot plasma from outside the shuttle must have leaked into the spacecraft through some sort of a breach. Just what the breach could be is a mystery. One possibility is that tiles damaged during liftoff exposed the metal skin of the shuttle to high temperatures, and it melted, causing a hole to form. But it's also possible that a piece of space junk could have pierced the shuttle while it was in orbit. NASA plans further tests to pinpoint the location of the hole. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
Hundreds of British troops patrolled London's airports today amid concerns about a possible terrorist attack. British Prime Minister Tony Blair declined to give specifics about the threats.
We cannot and shouldn't start disclosing details of everything we know or may know. But it's important we take every precaution we can in order to keep people safe.
Police at London's Gatwick Airport said they arrested a Venezuelan man who was found to be carrying a grenade in his luggage. A Home Office spokesman said there is no indication whether the man was involved with terrorism. Two other men were arrested near Heathrow Airport, but police didn't say what led to the arrests. In other news, the House has overwhelmingly approved a $397 billion measure funding most agencies for the rest of the year. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
Fresh Air, I'm Terry Gross. As we brace for war with Iraq, we also face a crisis with North Korea. North Korea has started up an old nuclear reactor that can produce plutonium for nuclear weapons and has removed spent nuclear fuel rods from storage. Yesterday, the UN's chief nuclear arms inspector declared North Korea in noncompliance with the Nuclear Nonproliferation Agreement and said the country posed a major security threat. The International Atomic Energy Agency voted to bring the North Korea issue to the UN Security Council. Also yesterday, CIA Director George Tenet said that North Korea was likely to process the spent nuclear fuel from its reactor, which would provide it with enough plutonium for several additional nuclear weapons. The CIA estimates that North Korea already has one or two nuclear bombs, as well as a missile that could possibly reach the west coast of America. My guest, Nicholas Kristof, is a columnist for The New York Times. He's covered both North and South Korea on and off since 1986. He's been the Times bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo. I asked Kristof about the importance of bringing this issue of North Korea to the international community.
Well, I think we have to do something. And there's a sense that North Korea is marching toward turning itself into a plutonium factory in a really dangerous way. And the administration doesn't really know what to do, and it doesn't want to talk to the North Koreans. And this is one way of trying to engineer some kind of international reaction, then later bringing international pressure through the Security Council and maybe economic sanctions. And also just to show domestically that, hey, it's doing something, so that when people like me write that it should be doing more, it can say, hey, we're doing something.
The next step is the UN Security Council. What is the UN Security Council likely to do? What are its options?
First off, the Security Council will, express, serious concern, this kind of thing. It'll, pursue some kind of diplomatic language and wring its hands in kind of a very international diplomatic way. But I don't think it'll actually take specific action the first time around. Then somewhat later, maybe a month later, maybe more, I think there is going to be real pressure for economic sanctions. And there'll be a vigorous debate about that because I think a lot of the international community will want to go that route. North Korea will warn that if we do, that'll be an act of war. And South Korea is very likely to be dead set against it. And China is going to have a lot of reservations as well.
Russia has threatened to vote against sanctions on the grounds that it could worsen North Korea's reaction.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems is that, I think everybody is concerned about North Korea developing a lot of nuclear weapons and the potential for selling them all over the world. But anything that puts pressure on it is going to create real risk, especially for all the neighbors. China's terrified that North Korea is going to collapse, among other things. South Korea is worried both that it's going to, explode and also that it's going to implode. Japan is worried, I think, quite legitimately, that the first reaction of any kind of North Korean dictator when times get tough is to send a missile off to Tokyo. So for all the neighbors, there is a real concern about putting too much pressure on North Korea, even though they do share our long-term goal of, keeping it nuclear-free.
North Korea says that it could interpret sanctions as a declaration of war. Why would North Korea interpret sanctions as a declaration of war?
A lot of that is probably bluster. No country is better than just saying outrageous things than North Korea. But they get a lot of leverage that way. I mean, they make us all really genuinely nervous about sanctions, and they are so unpredictable and so rash that it is indeed quite plausible. But I mean, my bet is that they're already so isolated that if there were sanctions that were applied but really didn't make a huge difference, and they probably wouldn't, then North Korea would, you know, they would not launch a war that would be suicidal. One reason why they would probably not be hugely affected by sanctions is that I think China is going to be very reluctant to really apply them vigorously, and that China-North Korean border is a porous one through which people, food, everything else goes, and I don't think China is going to want to close that off.
And it looks like the Bush administration doesn't want to negotiate a deal with North Korea independently, because why?
President Bush is concerned, and I mean, it's a perfectly legitimate concern about rewarding bad behavior. And, you know, he's concerned about being blackmailed by North Korea. And, I mean, I think we should be negotiating, but I do have to confess that, you know, it really is in many ways like blackmail. And North Korea has a long history of this. They warn that, you know, they start some outrageous project, a nuclear or whatever else, and then demand a payoff unless, or they'll keep it up. And so I think it's a perfectly legitimate concern. It's just that the alternatives are even worse.
What does North Korea want?
There's a big debate about that right now. There are some North Korea experts who say North Korea basically just wants a deal with the West, and especially with the U.S. It wants some kind of a peace treaty with the U.S. It wants Western investment, Western loans, normalization of relations, this kind of thing. And it's willing to trade away its missiles and its nuclear program to get that. And that's perfectly plausible. Kim Jong-il has shown a real interest in getting that. The other theory is that, you know, basically North Korea wants nuclear weapons. And since the 1950s, it's been trying to get them. And, you know, maybe it's willing at times to trade them away for a really great deal. But, you know, fundamentally, it wants nukes. My own sense is that they're both true, that it's not just developing nukes to trade them away, but it really does genuinely want them. And now, watching what happens to Iraq, because it doesn't have nukes, it wants them even more. But that it also does want relations with the U.S. and is willing to give up quite a bit to get them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. He's covered North and South Korea off and on for many years, dating back to 1986. Since 1986, he served as Hong Kong bureau chief, Beijing bureau chief, and Tokyo bureau chief. You've warned in your New York Times column several times that the North Korean nuclear crisis is more perilous than many people realize. Why?
Because I think almost any outcome is really terrifying. I mean, the one outcome is that they simply ramp up their nuclear program and go full speed toward developing, you know, every mechanism to get more nuclear weapons and missiles to deliver them. And in a few months, they'll have another 5 or 6 nuclear weapons. Within a few years, they'll be turning out 60 a year. And the way they make money is to sell weapons. I mean, I think in terms of proliferation, who they could sell them to, that's an absolutely terrifying prospect. But partly because it's so terrifying, I think there's a good chance, maybe a growing chance, since we're unwilling to talk to the North Koreans, that we're going to solve it another way, which is with a military strike on the Yongbyon nuclear plant sometime in the late spring or summer. And, you know, that may work brilliantly. It may solve the problem, but there's a very good chance that it'll start a new Korean War. And a Korean War would be an order of magnitude different from anything we might encounter in Iraq. A Pentagon study suggested that you could have 1 million people die in another Korean War. I mean, North Korea not only has a couple of nuclear weapons, we believe, also has 5,000 tons of sarin nerve gas. It may have smallpox. It's a huge armed forces, more than 1 million fighters. The prospect of that kind of a war is just completely terrifying.
Play out that scenario for us. You say 1 million people might die. Where would those 1 million people be living?
The real problem with a Korean War is that Seoul is right up next to the border with North Korea. It's only about 30 miles from the border. So a plane flying from North Korea can get to Seoul in just a few minutes. Then you have artillery all along the border, dug into the hillside. So it's very difficult for the U.S. to get rid of it. And that artillery can reach Seoul. And they have artillery shells with things like sarin, nerve gas. And so while the southern end of the peninsula could escape, and indeed, you know, North Korea would lose this kind of war, but in the process, they can destroy Seoul and turn it into what they brag is about is a sea of flames, and they can do that. And so I think that's why the administration has been very reluctant to move toward that kind of an approach, a military strike. But I think that the logic of where they're going, and you kind of hear bits of it from Washington, that is kind of where things may be headed.
What is the logic of North Korea destroying part of South Korea when South Korea is pretty lukewarm toward the United States right now, lukewarm at best? It's the United States that North Korea would really be antagonistic to. So why destroy South Korea?
Well, partly really because they can't reach the U.S. Now, they can reach Japan, and indeed, kind of the compromise measure would be that they would send a few missiles into Tokyo. One of the fundamental questions is, if we have a surgical military strike on the Yongbyon reactor, or just on the reprocessor within that reactor facility, then how will North Korea react? And I think that, I mean, the Pentagon, the hawks at least, that they bet that if we use a very, very surgical strike, you know, one or two cruise missiles, just a few cruise missiles, that then North Korea will just sit and accept it rather than risk a suicidal war. On the other hand, there are a lot of North Korean defectors, a lot of South Koreans, who think that at that point, pride is so critical for the North Korean regime, for the legitimacy of Kim Jong-il, that he will have to respond in a major way, and that if he thinks that he is losing his military strength, that he wants to use it before he loses it, and that he would unleash a second Korean War. And indeed, that compromise scenario is that he would lob a few missiles into Japan, and that would show that he's, you know, responding, that he's strong, but would be somewhat less likely to start a new war that he would lose.
You know, trying to figure out where pride comes into this for Kim Jong-il, I mean, trying to psychoanalyze him in any way and figure out what his move would be strikes me as probably a very difficult thing to do.
It is, and it's fascinating to look at what intelligence analysts have said about Kim Jong-il over the years. You know, for years and years and years, you would get these incredibly lurid tales of Kim Jong-il and these fast cars and these Swedish blondes who were imported and living in Pyongyang and these S&M videotapes. And just, you know, it was the most incredibly interesting intel that ever arose from anywhere in the world. And then really just a few years ago, you know, the intel community began to kind of calm down and people began to say, you know, actually he's, you know, he's a pretty smart, shrewd guy, Kim Jong-il, and he may have this playboy side to him, but the word coming out from defectors is that he was a pretty good negotiator, and indeed North Korea did seem to manage us pretty well and managed to get us in a pickle pretty well, and that he's, you know, he watches CNN and this kind of thing, and so a much more kind of nuanced version of reality started to come out, but we're an awful long way from understanding that guy.
My guest is Nicholas Kristof, a columnist for the New York Times who has covered North and South Korea. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Nicholas Kristof is my guest. He's a columnist for the New York Times. He's covered North and South Korea off and on since 1986. He served as the Times bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo. So let's just sum up what the options are that the Bush administration has. If the Bush administration decides to bomb the nuclear program in Pyongyang, that would be seen as a declaration of war. North Korea has said sanctions would be interpreted as a declaration of war. So what are the options here?
There are basically three options, and you know, there are variations on each. But one is to try to negotiate, and that might or might not work. But my sense is it'd be worth trying. And I think the State Department, you get the sense that Colin Powell and Richard Armitage would very much like to pursue that. Second alternative is to maybe go to sanctions that aren't terribly effective, maybe to, you know, deplore what's going on, but really not do anything very effective and hope that North Korea collapses of its own weight pretty soon and just let North Korea go ahead with its nuclear program. There were, a few months ago, there were some hints from the administration that was kind of going to be its strategy, that it thought that a strike was impossible and that negotiation was impossible, so we would just kind of let North Korea go ahead. Now, the third possibility is a military strike, and I think that momentum is headed very slightly in that direction. And, you know, it's a gamble because it might work brilliantly in the sense that North Korea might not respond, or it might work catastrophically with a new Korean war.
How do you think the preparations for war in Iraq is affecting the Bush administration response to North Korea?
I think that it's affecting it in the sense that the top levels of the U.S. government really can't do things simultaneously. They can't deal with more than one crisis at the same time. You know, the Pentagon likes to say that it can fight two wars simultaneously. Maybe it can, but the White House can't focus on two major crises at the same time. Yesterday, one person who'd been in government and for a long time said, you know, that the government can walk and chew gum at the same time, but it chews very slowly and walks very slowly. And I think that that's fundamentally the problem, that the cost of the preparations for Iraq has been that we haven't paid attention to North Korea. I think the administration really blew it in the fall when they didn't focus and they thought that North Korea would back down. And in fact, it was pretty clear to most North Korea experts that North Korea was more likely, if people weren't paying attention, to just kind of up the ante and make sure that they were heard. And indeed, that's what happened.
Sometimes it almost sounds like North Korea keeps upping the ante and saying, hey, look, this could be a big war. You know, a million people could die. Hello, are you listening?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. That's exactly it. Because we cut off the fuel oil supplies to North Korea, and its economy is very dependent on that kind of energy. So for North Korea's point of view, the present situation really isn't a great one. And so it wants to get some kind of a new major package deal with the U.S. And that would involve new sources of energy. It would involve investment, loans, normalization, that kind of thing. And it has discovered that the way it, you know, its leverage to get that kind of a deal is to do things that are really dangerous and wacky. And, you know, one of those was to crank up its nuclear program again. And it did that. I think the next way it's going to do that is going to be to remind us that it has missiles that can reach a long way. So it's likely to announce that a resumption of its missile tests, and indeed probably to fire off a Taepodong missile off into the Pacific. It can also ratchet tensions up by announcing formally that it is a nuclear state. You know, there it can always have, you know, fire a machine gun across the border a little bit and, you know, sink the South Korean stock market and the Tokyo stock market. There are all kinds of things it can do to put a lot of pressure on to make sure that we won't just forget about it.
Now, President Bush has made it clear that he didn't want to have the kind of deal with North Korea that the Clinton administration did. He thought the Clinton administration kind of let itself be blackmailed by North Korea. President Bush's father, the first President Bush, faced a crisis with North Korea in 1989. What was that crisis about, and how did the first President Bush deal with it?
There were indeed indications earlier that North Korea was developing had a nuclear program and was working toward nuclear weapons. And the first President Bush dealt with it essentially the way everybody else has until this administration, which is to try to offer inducements to North Korea to behave better, even if that does risk rewarding bad behavior. So the first President Bush withdrew nuclear weapons from the South. He canceled military exercises that were always a big source of contention on the Korean Peninsula. And there were hints. He started up talks between the U.S. and North Korea on a very, very low level in Beijing. And this was precisely an effort to try to create a dialogue with the North Koreans and to, you know, create some kind of environment where we could do some kind of a package deal with them.
Now, you had said earlier that North Korea hasn't announced formally that it's a nuclear state, that it might make that announcement. North Korea hasn't acknowledged that it's a nuclear state?
They in fact, deny it. They say that they're, you know, trying to develop peaceful nuclear power, that they've started up their reactor in Yongbyon to get power. In fact, that is complete hocus-pocus. I'm told that the power lines at Yongbyon actually aren't connected to the electrical grid in North Korea at all. So it's for nuclear power, but they don't acknowledge that.
Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By Windham Hill Records, presenting George Winston's new solo piano CD, Night Divides the Day, The Music of the Doors, available at Borders Books and Music. And from Harmony Books, a member of the Crown Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, publishers of 10 Poems to Open Your Heart by Roger Hoosden. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof describes his travels through North Korea and explains why he thinks it's an even more repressive country than Iraq. The disagreement over Iraq between the U.S. and France has led to a lot of French bashing here. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been listening in. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Nicholas Kristof, a columnist for the New York Times. He's covered North and South Korea on and off since 1986. He's served as the Times bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo. Let's pick up where we left off. Would you compare? You've been both to Iraq and North Korea. Go ahead.
North Korea is the, you know, only place in the world that makes Iraq look like a liberal democracy. Iraq is an incredibly brutal and repressive place, but, you know, it's basically a country where you get people coming in and going out, and people watch, listen to foreign radio. I mean, they even listen to Israeli radio, which just surprised me in Iraq. And there is information that does get around. People are willing to say in whispers when nobody else is listening what they do think of the government. North Korea is just a world apart. North Korea is incomparably the most Stalinist country that has ever existed in history. If you're a North Korean, you can't travel from one place to another without permission. You can't live in Pyongyang, the capital, without permission. You have to wear your badge every moment. People are categorized into categories of loyalty. There's a speaker in every house that dishes out propaganda from the government from morning to evening. It is incomparably more repressive and more rigid than any other country I've ever been to or imagined, incomparably more repressive than Russia under Stalin, for example.
What are some of the things you're likely to hear on the speaker that you're obliged to leave in your house and leave turned on 24 hours a day?
Actually, North Korea has great propaganda in that sense. It's better than all the sort of boring propaganda that a lot of communist countries put out. North Korea's is, this sort of hair on the chest stuff about the American war maniacs and their South Korean puppets and how they're threatening war, and it's always sort of fabricating ridiculous charges. And then the hagiography about Kim Jong-il and his father, Kim Il-sung, is, again, just the greatest, stuff to listen to, at least if you're not a North Korean. I mean, it's incredibly amusing if you're a foreigner. Periodically, there are all these reports about supernatural phenomena that, my favorite was the white sea anemone, an albino sea anemone that came to shore and found a fisherman's net to be caught in so that it could celebrate Kim Jong-il's accession to power. You have flowers that are blooming in midwinter but to celebrate Kim Jong-il's birthday, this kind of thing. So you get this kind of propaganda and kind of celebrate. In many ways, it's really like going to a religious state, some kind of a medieval theocracy. And Kim Jong-il, is the god. And so you get all this kind of religious sort of worshipful praise of him. And that's very much the tone of what it's gone. And heretics are executed, of course, which, makes the parallel a little closer as well. And this just booms into people from, morning. It wakes them up in the morning, and then it puts them to sleep at night.
And apparently disabled people are exiled.
Yeah. I had heard that before I went to North Korea, that disabled people were not allowed in Pyongyang because they kind of marred the image of the city, that they just gave a bad impression of, the one place that foreigners were likely to go to. And so the whole time I was in Pyongyang, I was kind of rushing around trying desperately to find anybody, who was missing an arm or a leg or who was blind or anything. And there weren't any. And I asked the authorities, where there were any. And they insisted, well, there aren't any because they voluntarily moved to other parts of the country. But it just underscores the incredibly rigid control that the government has over absolutely everything that goes on.
So in your opinion, North Korea is even a more rigid and bizarre place to live than Iraq. How would you compare the risks that North Korea and Iraq pose for the rest of the world?
I think that they both pose risks, but I think that the North Korean risk is considerably greater. Part of that, certainly for Americans. Now, part of that is that Iraq, I think, probably does have weapons of mass destruction, but that's mainly chemicals and biological agents. And it doesn't have any good way of delivering them. It's, you know, experimented, it's tried, but as far as we know, it doesn't have any good way of delivering them with shells or with missiles or with other mechanisms. And certainly doesn't have anything that can get very far. On the other hand, North Korea has those chemicals and those biological agents in huge quantities. I mean, 5,000 tons of sarin nerve gas, just vast amounts of anthrax. We believe it has smallpox. And it also has ways of delivering them. It has perfected ways of putting them in shells so that they can, you know, be delivered through artillery or through missiles. And North Korea also has a long-range ballistic missile program. Its Nodong missiles can reach Japan with no difficulty, and its latest missile, the Taepodong 2, could reach Alaska or Hawaii and deliver a warhead to those places. And in a three-stage version, it could probably reach at least the West Coast and perhaps further inland, depending on the size of the warhead. And as we know, it does have nukes, and we don't know where those existing nuclear warheads are hidden, so we can't remove them. So it seems to me that both in terms of what they have in terms of weapons of mass destruction and in terms of their ways of delivering them to us, North Korea is a much more frightening place than Iraq. And you know, North Korea also has a legacy of involvement in terrorism, although it's been some years. That was back in the 1980s and earlier. And the fact that if any war erupts, then we've got 100,000 U.S. troops in the region who will be vulnerable.
If North Korea sells nuclear materials or other weapons of mass destruction to terrorist groups, do you think it would be for ideological reasons or primarily for the money?
I think for the money. I think North Korea is really less and less ideological all the time. There were some fascinating tape conversations between Kim Jong-il and a couple of people who he had actually kidnapped from the South years ago. And those tapes were then brought out by them to the West. And they suggest that Kim Jong-il really doesn't particularly believe in communism. I mean, he knows that it's not an effective way to get an economy going. He's clearly tried at various points to initiate economic reform. He's also very nervous, though, about the political consequences of that. And I think that that is kind of what he's balancing. He wants to stay on top. He likes this kind of traditional system of being a divine king. And yet he also wants the economy to grow. And it's very hard to figure out how to reconcile those two. But I don't think that at this point that he's an ideologue. I think that he's very, very practical and is out to make money.
Some experts have said that the Bush administration came to the White House with the agenda already in place of taking out Saddam Hussein. Do you think the Bush administration had any agenda regarding North Korea when it came to the White House?
No, I think not nearly to the same degree. I think, though, that the administration has a very strong sense of, you know, that policies should be, you know, ABC, anything but Clinton policies. And there was a strong sense that the 1994 agreed framework under the Clinton administration had not worked very well, that it had meant giving in to blackmail. And so I think there was a real distaste for that, for the agreed framework. And indeed, maybe that would have fallen apart even if the North had not cheated on the nuclear program. So I think that where the President Bush and the White House came in was not so much a determination to remove Kim Jong-il in the way that there were some people determined to remove Saddam, but rather a real distaste for the regime in North Korea and a distaste for dialogue and for concessions.
In examining how the Bush administration is reacting to the threat of Iraq and the threat of North Korea, some people say, well, the Bush administration is doing the right thing for each of the countries. Each country demands its own unique response. And other people are saying the Bush administration is being very hypocritical in preparing for war with Iraq, which isn't nearly as much of a threat as North Korea is, and doing very little with North Korea.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that there definitely is a certain hypocrisy there, because Iraq, I think, is less of a threat than North Korea. On the other hand, in fairness, I mean, hypocrisy is kind of what governments do at times in foreign affairs when the choices are bad. And, you know, officials have a point. I mean, they privately say, look, Saddam is a government that we can overthrow, and North Korea is one that, however distasteful, if we try to overthrow it, I mean, you will have another Korean War, and you will have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of casualties. And so that there is a difference in a reason to treat them differently. I mean, I have problems with the government's approach to both Iraq and North Korea, but I do have to acknowledge that there is it is understandable why one would go for Iraq rather than North Korea, just based on how they can respond.
My guest is Nicholas Kristof, a columnist for The New York Times who has covered North and South Korea. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Nicholas Kristof is my guest. He's a columnist for The New York Times. He's covered North and South Korea on and off since 1986. He's been the Times bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo. Let's look at President Bush's relationship with the new president of South Korea, who actually takes office in late February, No Moon Hun. Why is there so much tension now between the Bush administration and the newly elected president of South Korea?
There's a fundamental dispute about how to handle North Korea. The South Korean government, both the outgoing government of Kim Dae-jung and the new government of No Moo-hyun, they think that engagement is the way to go. And they think that just the worst possible solution would be a military strike on Yongbyon, because they would be the ones at risk. And the Bush administration thinks that the worst way to go is engagement, because you're rewarding people for doing bad things. And there are certainly voices in the administration who think that a military strike may eventually be the way to go. So there is a complete disjunction in terms of what the two administrations see as the relevant options. It's coupled just by within South Korea, there's a growing kind of distaste for the U.S. There's resentment at the U.S. military presence there. It hasn't often been handled very well either by the South Koreans or by the U.S. And I think we're now paying the price for it.
How strong is anti-American feeling now in South Korea?
It's really mixed, and a lot of it is age-dependent. Among older people, you get a tremendous warmth often toward Americans, people who remember the Korean War or grew up in its aftermath and feel tremendous respect for the U.S. Among younger people, I'd say there's a growing nationalism, growing assertiveness. People think that, South Korea is now an industrialized country, and they want more respect, and they resent it when they see U.S. forces running around South Korea, taking up prime real estate, committing, in some cases, crimes, and in their view, not being punished for it adequately. One constant source of tension is that the U.S. troops are disproportionately male, and a lot of them date Korean women, which creates tremendous anger and resentment among a lot of young Korean men. So I think there are a lot, and also I think a lot of young South Koreans just really don't see North Korea as a threat. And they think that the prime risk comes from the U.S. presence there triggering some kind of a conflagration. So you get a lot of mixed up reasons, but among young people, kind of a real lack of appreciation for the U.S. military presence and I think a growing distaste for it.
Is a new president of South Korea thinking seriously about reunification with the North?
I don't think so. I think that it's an aspiration of all Koreans. It's sort of a slogan that people have always been raised on. But after they watched the German reunification, they became terrified about just the cost of it. And so I think that, you know, they want, you know, reunification, but not yet. And their main concern, I had a fascinating meeting with No Mo-hyun, the new president, in which he made clear that his real fear is not North Korean attack as such, but rather a U.S. military strike on the Yongbyon facility, which would lead to a broader war.
You've made it clear that you have criticisms of the Bush administration and its handling of Iraq and North Korea. I'm just interested in hearing your opinion about what you think the Bush administration should be doing on those fronts.
On North Korea, I think that it's critical that we start a negotiation as soon as possible. If the administration wants diplomatic cover to do so and to, you know, pretend it's not changing its position, then the best way to do that would be through an international conference involving, you know, maybe the Chinese, the Russians, the Japanese, the South Koreans, and the U.S. and North Korea. But I mean, everybody will know that the key dialogue there is going to be between North Korea and the U.S. And North Korea would have to give up its nuclear program in entirety. It would have to consent to some degree of verification, inspectors, this kind of thing. And then the U.S. would offer normalization of relations, loans from the Asian Development Bank, trade, and anti-economic sanctions. And it seems to me that one important element of this is these are things we should be doing on our own. I mean, this is the way to bring down North Korea, is precisely to engage it, to send Western business men and women over there. This is the most isolated country in the world, and that is precisely why it has managed to keep Kim Jong-il in power. And now if Kim Jong-il wants Western contact, which is precisely what is most dangerous to him, I think we should hand it to him.
And Saddam Hussein?
And Saddam Hussein, I think that, Saddam worries me, but I think that a war worries me even more in terms of the potential downside throughout the region. I mean, one of my fears is that the first regime change we could see would be in Jordan, not in Iraq, or, you know, in Pakistan. I think that after Saddam goes, that we'll have an enormous mess, especially in the south, in the Shiite region. And so I think that containment is a viable option, just as we have contained Iraq in the past, just as we contained Libya, just as we contained Nasser's Egypt, for example. Both of which also had weapons of mass destruction programs. And so I agree with the diagnosis of all that is wrong with Saddam, but I don't buy the prescription, and I think that containment is a better prescription.
Nicholas Kristof, thank you very much, and safe travels to you.
Thank you very much.
Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for the New York Times. He's also worked as the Times bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo. Some Americans have been engaging in vigorous French bashing in reaction to the French rift with the U.S. over Iraq. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the peculiar language of French bashing. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The resistance of some European nations to the Bush administration's position on Iraq has provoked a torrent of anti-European commentary in the press, a great deal of it directed at the French. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been listening to all the French bashing and the peculiar vocabulary that some writers reserve for talking about the French.
As I read through recent commentaries on European responses to U.S. policy on Iraq, I keep running into the adjective Gallic. The great dismal fog of Gallic anti-Americanism, the duplicities of Gallic diplomacy, Gallic intransigence on Iraq. An op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times described the French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin as displaying a Gallic insouciance to Colin Powell's presentation before the Security Council. And at least three other columns describe the French reaction to the speech as a Gallic shrug. It's an odd word, one of a handful of fanciful adjectives like Hibernian for the Irish, Caledonian for the Scots, and Teutonic for the Germans, words that journalists keep handy to conjure up a familiar national stereotype. The cluster of nouns that gravitate toward Gallic suggests the mix of infatuation and exasperation that the French always invoke for us. Phrases like Gallic charm and Gallic flair are paired with Gallic rudeness and Gallic arrogance, and of course those Gallic shrugs, a phrase that turns up almost 700 times in the Nexus newspaper databases. And then there's Gallic logic. As far as I can tell, the French are the only people we credit with having a national logic of their own. But one way or another, Gallic always goes with character traits. You don't see people talking about Gallic aircraft carriers or Gallic pharmaceutical companies. According to Edward Knox, a professor at Middlebury who's studied the way France is reported in the American press, Gallic isn't really a synonym for French at all. It's more like shorthand for the French are at it again. Gallic is just one of the special words that journalists have consecrated to the French. In press stories, the French are always fuming about something or other, and where other people say things, the French sniff them, as in, "We were not informed of the decision," the minister sniffed. In fact, the adjective sniffy is another favorite here, and the French are described as snooty even more often than the English are. In the American press, the Frenchman is a character who's guided by his nose, whereas the German is a character who's led by it. Journalists have been dining out on these turns of phrase since Mark Twain's time, but it's striking how readily they come up when the French are proving obstinate over American policy. You don't often hear Teutonic used in the same way to describe the Germans' reluctance to go along. Not long ago, the London Times columnist Michael Gove suggested that the Germans' present pacifism grows out of a historic weakness in the German character, of the same sort that led to Hitlerism. But most Americans would see that as a stretch. Whatever annoyance they may feel about the German position, they don't feel the need to connect it to Colonel Klink. One reason why journalists single out the French is just because they can. The French happen to be one of the few European nationalities who don't have an American constituency to look out for their interests. You wonder how commentators would have reacted if the Italians had sided with the French and the Germans in opposing American policy on Iraq. I doubt they'd be bringing up the Italian reputation for military faint-heartedness the way Representative Peter King did with the French when he suggested that they could go to Baghdad to instruct the Iraqis in how to surrender. And you can be sure that critics wouldn't be throwing around epithets like wops and dagos the way they have with frogs. True, the French have an annoying habit of vaunting their sense of cultural superiority to Americans. But the Italians, Germans, and English have exactly the same condescending attitude, though as with the French, it's usually mixed with a genuine affection for the engaging upstarts of the New World. If there's a difference between the French and the others, it has more to do with an ambivalence about the cachet that French culture still has in this country. Often you sense that the animus is directed less at the French than at Francophiles, the people the right likes to describe as the Chablis and Brie set. It brings to mind what Mark Twain said in The Innocents Abroad about the Frenchified American he runs into in a Venice hotel, sporting a rose in his buttonhole and calling Paris Paris. Oh, it is pitiable to see him making of himself a thing that is neither male nor female, neither fish, flesh, nor fowl, a poor, miserable, hermaphrodite Frenchman. You could hear that same disdain for the American Francophiles in a recent National Review piece by the conservative columnist Victor Davis Hanson. As he put it, "Heartland Americans, far from being deprived yokels, have a clearer appreciation of the quite profound amorality in Europe than anybody in the Ivy League. But it was notable that Hansen couldn't get out of that commentary without throwing in an indignant mon Dieu. In fact, whenever you see the word Gallic in a story, it's dollars to beignets, it will be followed by a phrase like tête-à-tête, or je ne sais quoi, or vive la différence, just so the writers can make it clear that they aren't deprived yokels themselves. As the critics of the French are always making a point of saying, believe me, I've been there. That's why French bashing is a perennially satisfying exercise. It permits you to take a stick to the decadent European wussiness of your compatriots while at the same time making a show of your own cosmopolitan savoir-faire. A pity the French are so given to Gallic touchiness, or they'd see it all for the tribute it really is.
Jeff Nunberg is a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center and the author of the book The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Cinema Therapy for Lovers, The Couple's Guide to Finding Happiness One Movie at a Time by Nancy Pesky and Beverly West. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publisher of Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, the book that inspired The Hours. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Simpsons broadcasts its 300th episode this Sunday. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons, Harry Shearer, who does the voices of Mr. Burns and Smithers, and Alf Clausen, who composes the music. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.